has not detected anything, but what she isn't telling us is whether she actually has the ability to do so, Holly said.
Exactly, Sophie said.
Sonia, what is the effective range of electromagnetic signal detection on the rhino?
Currently 2.6 kilometers,
the AI replied.
That was extremely low. They should be able to detect EM signals at a couple hundred kilometers at least.
And optic signaling, Sophie tried.
0 meters.
How the hell is that possible? Diego said. His words trailed off and he slumped in the driver's seat. Oh, God, the damage we took in that organic attack.
Exactly, Sophie said. We'll need to repair the comm equipment and the sensor arrays.
Ort straightened in his seat, craning his neck to look back at Sophie. Then we get our comm systems back online and send a message to the colony?
No.
Sophie pushed herself up from the seat. A wave of pain followed, and she almost fell. Emmanuel reached to help her, but she waved him off.
We can't risk sending any communications. We've got to go for passive detection. The last thing we want is to send out a beacon that calls all the organics to our position.
Sophie moved to the supplies and started to shovel through them. Emmanuel watched her, concern in his gaze.
Trust me,
she said. This was her realm of expertise, and she needed to do something to help and keep her mind off all the worries. Besides, they'd all risked their lives to get her comatose self off the sunspot.
Sonia, identify potential reasons for communication system failure, along with expected probabilities of each, Sophie said.
Prompting the AI, she troubleshot all the potential realms of failures for the comm systems. Emmanuel worked as her assistant as they replaced fuses and removed melted wires behind a panel near the controls. The rhino continued onward, bouncing over the terrain as they worked. The group shared rationed meals and water, all the while keeping a nervous eye out the windows. Holly and Balma entertained Jamie and Owen, sharing bits of an MRE with them. Ort drove for a while, giving Diego a chance to rest. Hours ticked by. Hours they didn't have. They hadn't detected any organics tailing them before, which had given them a false sense of security. Now the suspicion was that they might not have detected them simply because of their compromised comm system and sensor arrays. For all Sophie knew, the aliens were toying with them, waiting until she succumbed to the nanobots. She continued working, even as the pain spread from her head and into her muscles. The nanobots were probably burrowing into her nerves and muscles now, remodeling their new home and turning her into a compliant organic host. She vowed she wouldn't give them the pleasure of finishing their job. As she put the last pieces in place to connect one of the rhino's antennas to a repaired nano-circuit board, she eyed the Arvamp. When she felt reality slipping from her fingers once again, she would activate that device, aiming it at herself. This time she might well fry her own nervous system completely. Yes, risking her own life with the Arvamp was definitely better than the alternative. They might have already lost Jeff and David, and there was no way she would be responsible for any more deaths. She slapped a plate back over the nano-circuit board.
That's it. Sonia, bring comm systems and sensor arrays back online.
A low hum resonated through the rhino.
All systems back online, Sonia said.
The rest of the group cheered, but Sophie didn't share in their joy. The systems might be online, but that didn't mean the range of detection limits were restored to adequate levels yet.
Give me a gauge of system functionality relative to full, Sophie said.
Diego gave her a look like she'd just spoken in Russian.
65% of normal, Sonia said.
That should be enough, Sophie said.
Ort, see anything on the display now? Ort's face drained of color and his mouth fell open.
We got a signal.
They drove on. The distance between the rhino and the mysterious signal was closing. Diego studied the display. Now that they were closer, their IR sensor arrays had kicked in. They still didn't have a visual on where the signal was originating, but at least they had new intel.
Sonia, Diego said, what does this new IR signal mean?
We are within detection limits of the unidentified object.
Yeah, I get that,
Diego said. He reminded himself to talk in AI language like Sophie had done.
What are the probabilities that this signature is that of the NTC colony?
I have no information regarding the purported energy output or the physical size of the NTC colony. Calculating such a probability is impossible. Please provide the inputs.
I think I can handle that, Sophie spoke up. She was sitting in one of the back seats. Jamie had her head in Sophie's lap, and Sophie was stroking the girl's hair. She gave Sonia rough estimates on the size of the colony and drew up some quick calculations to estimate the energy output.
Sonia, please use the maximum and minimum values I've provided to calculate a range of possibilities for this unidentified object being an NTC colony.
Sonia disappeared for a moment. Diego blinked, and she was back on their screens.
Dr. Winston, according to the values you provided, there is a 0% chance that the signature matches that of the colony if it is functional.
If the colony is functional? Diego asked. What does functional have to do with it?
Dr. Winston provided values for a colony that had been damaged or operating below normal as well,
Sonia continued.
However, these values, too, do not match up.
Then what the hell are we looking at?
Diego asked.
Sonia began to explain. We are looking at an electro...
No!
Diego interrupted. He let himself slip into another phrase the AI had taken too literally.
I mean, what is another potential explanation for this signal?
According to the data I do have from the sunspot, the signal is within the expected range for a ship of that size and nature, Sonia said.
Holy shit, Diego said. Another NTC ship out there? Would that signature match a functional ship?
That would be correct, Sonia said.
Why the hell didn't you tell us that in the first place? Diego asked Sonia.
Because you didn't ask.
Diego's chest felt light. This wasn't exactly an NTC colony, but an NTC ship that was actually in working order had to be a good sign.
Hopefully.
As they carried on toward the signal, Diego worked hard not to get his hopes up. Memories of the radiant dawn haunted any ounce of optimism that dared buoy his spirits. The signal only continued to grow stronger, and Sonia's confidence that it was a ship like the sunspot increased as they went. Now even Sophie seemed to be unable to contain her anticipation. Bauma offered her his seat near the front display, and she gladly took it, monitoring their progress and any incoming signals from the ship.
"Should we send out a message?" Ward asked. "We're close enough to warn them we're coming."
Sophie shook her head.
"No.
Even now, I want passive detection only. If we try any kind of active signaling or communications, the organics may intercept it. The last thing we want is to broadcast our location when we're this close to another NTC ship."
Diego started to speak.
"That makes sense," but Sophie froze. Her sudden rigidness drew Diego's focus away from his driving.
"Something wrong?"
he asked. Instead of answering, Sophie's eyes rolled up. Her mouth locked open, and she slumped into her seat.
Chapter 13
Athena ignored Griffin's advice about sitting this mission out. Crossing the seabed again did terrify her, but she couldn't back down now, especially after her speech on the bridge. Her crew needed a leader. Since Captain Noble's capture and, likely, death, she had done everything she could to fill his shoes. Today, she wondered if she had done enough. Her crew was split on whether to stay or leave the submarine, but there was only one real option in her mind— leave the GOA and make the journey to Pelican AFB. She had promised Captain Noble she would take care of his crew, and that's exactly what she planned to do. She continued on point across the sand toward Los Angeles. Her muscles were still tight, and she was running on fumes. Griffin walked to her left, his RPG angled up and helmet scanning the blue sky above. Taylor flanked her on the right, his RPG also at the ready. Behind them, Trish and Malone held rear guard with pulse rifles and the remaining EMP grenades. The plan was simple. Head out to the location of the vehicles, and take them if they still worked, then head back to the GOA. People like Posey and Collins would, in the meantime,
have plenty of time to think about if they wanted to leave the submarine or not. Maybe if they saw working vehicles, they would change their minds. At this point, everyone she could save made a difference. Every single soul counted. She focused back on the sky with her new helmet. Today, the vast stretch of blue mirrored an ocean that no longer existed. Not a drop of water glimmered to the west. Nothing but cracked, tan earth. To the east, the great skyline of Los Angeles came into focus above the shimmering heat. Her HUD revealed the temperature was already at 118 degrees. That was the least of her worries right now. There were still organics in the city, and they needed all of their ammo for the trip to Pelican AFB. Athena balled her hand into a fist when they reached the street at the edge of the beach. Down the block, a few vehicles were partially exposed by the shifting sands. She looked for organics tracks, then motioned for the team to continue. They fanned out, half keeping to the left side of the street and the other half on the right side. Several buildings had collapsed, forming screes of debris around their bases that spilled over into the road. Griffin roved his pulse rifle back and forth across the exteriors of the structures. The RPG was slung over his back, now that they were safely away from the exposed seabed. Trish stopped to stare at something toward the east. "What is it?" Athena asked. But before Trish answered, she saw what had attracted the communications officer's attention. The blue sky had taken on a brown and yellow tint beyond the skyscrapers. Athena raised her scope to glass the storm. "We need to move," she said. The dust storm was moving fast, and the winds were stirring up smoke from fires. They had to get off the narrow chute of the street. The 100-mile-an-hour winds that came with storms like these would knock them away like bowling pins. She checked her HUD again to look for the nav marker she had set for the coordinates of the underground parking garage. Just 3 blocks to go. Her eyes flicked to the corresponding location down the street. A mountain of rubble lay between them and their destination. If they hurried, they could make it, provided they didn't run into hostiles. She motioned for the team to continue with a hand signal. They set off at a brisk pace, weapons clanking over armor loud enough she could hear it over the raging wind. Griffin's wide frame was the first to reach the pile of debris in the road. He raised his rifle, hunched down, and moved through a narrow gap where two piles nearly touched. Athena went next, ducking under a piece of rebar. Twisted metal scratched her armor. She cringed at the sound, but kept moving. Once the team was through, they set off down the next street, then took a left onto another block of office buildings. The structures towered over them, reaching 50 floors toward the sky. Griffin, Malone, and Taylor all stayed focused on the grimy exteriors, looking for contacts behind the shattered windows. While the aliens had caused the damage on the last street, nature had caused the damage here. Windows had been blown out by dust storms, and the asphalt was cracked from the heat. A fine layer of sand, dust, and grit covered everything. Griffin suddenly motioned for everyone to get off the road. The team bolted for cover through the open door of an office building and took up position in the lobby. By the time Athena made her way behind an overturned table, she realized they weren't all here. Trish was missing. Looking over the table, Athena scanned the road and found Trish crouched next to the bumper of a car. She had her rifle clutched against her chest and was aiming it at the building Athena and the others had taken refuge in.
Scratch, scrape, scratch, scrape.
Wind rushed down the street, whipping up a vortex of grime and blocking Athena's view of Trish. She cursed under her breath and looked to Griffin.
"I'll go grab her,"
he said, beginning to move before she had a chance to stop him. Athena watched the big Marine walk over to the door. They needed Trish. She was a skilled communications officer and engineer, and the only engineer on this mission, since Posey had refused to come. Without knowing what state the vehicles they wanted were in, they absolutely needed someone with engineering and mechanical experience. Griffin unslung his RPG and repositioned himself on the opposite side of the doorframe. The whistling of the wind combined with the scratching of claws outside, but the Marine wasn't deterred. He stepped out while Malone and Taylor moved over to Athena's position. A thump, followed by an almost instant explosion, rocked the building. Griffin moved back into the lobby as a waterfall of brick, glass, metal, and blue flesh slammed onto the sidewalk. 2 clawed spider legs stuck out of the pile, twitching. Come on, Griffin yelled to Trish. She hesitated, but then got to her feet and ran toward the pile. Griffin had already switched to his pulse rifle. He climbed up the smoldering wreckage and fired two rounds point blank into the spider's skull. Then he reached down to Trish and pulled her up and into the building. Out the back, he ordered. Athena patted his linebacker's shoulders with gratitude and followed the team through the lobby to locate the exit.
You okay?
She asked. Trish managed a nod.
They navigated the hallways at a breakneck pace, coming to the back door a few minutes later. Griffin checked the alleyway and then motioned for everyone to follow him. A cascade of wind beat the team back as they made their way down the narrow alley. The sky darkened overhead, taking on a brown, angry tint. The alley was filled with the sticky remains of orbs that hadn't dried out in the sun yet. Trash and plastic bottles stuck to the remains. Athena kept her focus on Griffin, watching his movements. He halted at the edge of the intersection with the sidewalk. Rows of shops towered across the street. Dark brown clouds swirled toward them, lightning flashing across the bulging storm. Over the noise came a scratchy whistle that sent a chill across Athena's body. Not spiders this time. The vampire-like alien that had escaped the attack the prior night was out there, hunting. This was the first time they had faced the beasts during the day, which told her it was desperate, and therefore even more dangerous.
Move,
she said. Keeping low, the team set off across the street. Violent gusts of wind bit into their suits, and Athena leaned into it with her helmet. Grit blinded her visor as the edge of the storm rushed into the road. They fought their way along, using the protection of the buildings. Hugging the exteriors, they moved in a chain toward the underground parking garage. Griffin located it a few minutes later and pulled open a gate to let them down a concrete stairwell.
Go, go, go!
He shouted. Looking over her shoulder, Athena spotted a pulsating blue light in the whipping wind covering the street. She strained to see through the cloud of sand, finally spotting a tail and a crustacean body moving through the cloud. Raising her rifle, she aimed for the approaching beast.
Come on!
Trish yelled.
Go, I'm right behind you,
Athena replied. She turned for a moment to watch as Trish and Malone went into the stairwell. Taylor went next. Griffin stood there motioning for Athena, but she pressed her visor back to her rifle scope. She couldn't let this thing follow them inside. But now she couldn't find it in the rush of wind.
Give me your launcher,
she ordered. The scream of the storm rose into a growl that made it difficult to hear Griffin shouting at her.
Give it to me!
She yelled again, handing her pulse rifle over. He gave her the launcher, then grabbed the back of her armor to hold her steady. She glimpsed the pulsating blue of the alien across the street, where it had scuttled behind a vehicle. It continued battling the torrent of sand, using its pincers to score ruts and pull itself through the gusts. The creature opened its mandibles to let out a screech. High-pitched whistling screamed from its slotted nostrils. Using a claw, it pulled itself around the car and homed in on her.
No, you don't,
she said, pulling the trigger. The grenade streaked into the wind and impacted to the right of the creature, blowing out a hunk of street with a claw still stuck in the asphalt. The body of the alien cartwheeled away from its severed limb, the storm taking it into the sky. She lowered the weapon and watched the pulsating blue vanish into the brown vortex. Griffin pulled on her armor, and she finally followed her team into the underground parking garage to take shelter.
Entry 10202. Designee AI Alexia. The loss of Commander Suzuki and his team of Japanese soldiers has me reevaluating my military strategy moving forward. While I was designed for a wide variety of functions, I was not given the military training that some other AIs are programmed with. I've improvised by studying military strategy and warfare. The organics are unlike any enemy the human race has seen, but they do have their weaknesses. My objective isn't to find a way to defeat them, but rather to find a way to help the remaining human survivors escape. Doing so may be the only way to prevent the extinction of the species that designed me. My plan to hack or commandeer the sharks failed with the death of Commander Suzuki and his squad, but I did have enough time to download the details of the operations systems before I lost contact with the soldiers. I'm not exactly back to square one, as humans say, but I'm still not any closer to understanding how the organic flight systems work. So here I am formulating a new plan for Corporal Athena Rollins and her ragtag crew while trying to dissect the schematics of the flight systems. While I work, the Corporal and her team are likely on their way to find the underground vehicles and take them to Pelican Air Force Base. The odds of making it and then crossing the desert without detection aren't good. However, there is a lot of organic drone activity in the vicinity due to the attack on Athena the previous night. I pull up the newest aerial view from Lolo. It just came in a few minutes ago, and I've sped through the recording to search for hostiles within a 300-mile radius. There are currently 4 drones in the sector and 2 sharks. My calculations show a 99% chance Corporal Rollins and her team will be detected either by ground troops or by the patrolling aircraft in the course of their journey to Pelican Air Force Base. That's where I come in. I'm working on a distraction, something to lead the aircraft out of the area and give them an opening. If I can do that, then the likelihood of success is nearly 65%. But the only way to cause the type of distraction they need is to do something I've tried to avoid until now. Tapping into the external biosphere operations system, I pull up the diagnostics for Cheyenne Mountain. There are plenty of ways to grab the attention of the organics, but I'm looking for the most effective, something they cannot ignore. My system scan shows that the air raid sirens are still functional on the east, west, and south sides of the mountain. The electromagnetic pulse that took down most human technology on Invasion Day did not penetrate deep enough to disable those sirens, much like it didn't destroy the systems inside the biosphere. But I'm also not sure if using them will be enough to bring the organic army down on Cheyenne Mountain. Perhaps there is something else, something. Ah, yes, here it is. I've been waiting to use these for a while. Tapping into the weapons system, I activate the 50-year-old missile launch system. While the missiles had all been removed when the facility was decommissioned, the operations system is still functional. If I can fake a launch, it might be enough to attract every organic within 1,000 miles or more. It's worth a shot, literally. I bring the system online and code a new launch. Whether or not it will do the trick remains to be seen. The sirens activate outside, and I use an external camera to monitor the skyline for alien ships. Meanwhile, I check Lolo to see if there are new images of the GOA. I discover a major dust storm ravaging Los Angeles. The storm is a Category 4. Not quite the worst, but a significant danger nonetheless. At least the sand will provide some cover for Corporal Rollins and her team until my plan has a chance to work. I notice a pending radio transmission from Lolo while scanning the video, the first in months. It has been encrypted and decrypted, delaying its arrival, a long process that tells me whoever sent it wanted to avoid organics translating it. I'm hopeful it's Dr. Winston's crew on the NTC Sunspot, but the emotion falls short of earning the excitement that a human might feel when I bring it up. To anyone that's listening, this is AI Sonia with the NTC Sunspot broadcasting from Mars. We believe we have located the colony, but there are also organics here. Stand by for more information.
My fear of organics on Mars has now been confirmed. This new message inspires more questions than answers. Dr. Hoffman believed the colony was the only hope for the human race. He believed the organics wouldn't return to Mars due to the fact it was already stripped of water. But now there is water there. Humans. I pause for a millisecond to consider the implications. Meanwhile, I pull up a view of Los Angeles. Corporal Athena's team is on the move through the city in 2 vehicles, a pickup and a van. My system slows another half second when I see what's tracking them. End entry.
A fire burned through Sophie. It felt as if the nanobots wanted retribution for being left dormant for so long. Every muscle in her body contracted until Sophie was afraid the muscle fibers would start tearing from the ligaments. She wanted to scream and yell, but she couldn't. The nanobots were taking over. Sophie could feel them swarming her body. For a moment, she could still see the world around her, confined to the space aboard the Rhino. Then everything went dark.
"Please,"
she managed. Her voice came out wispy and strangled. But at least it didn't hurt anymore. She flexed her fingers. They curled on command, and she stood. When her legs pushed her up,
There was no resistance against her feet. It was as if she was swimming now. She opened her eyes. Brilliant white light blinded her for a moment. Several seconds passed, during which she drowned in the intensity until her pupils adjusted. Her heart flipped when she realized she was flying. What in God's name had the nanobots done to her? A blanket of darkness lay overhead, punctuated by the flicker and burn of stars in the heavens. Below was the surface of Mars, as if it was day. The ground was like a carpet of lively embers. Deep canyons cut through a landscape filled with rock formations that had stood for eons, undisturbed and unwitnessed. She suddenly felt a deep longing, the same distant longing that had been there before. A vision flashed before her. All the red and rock had been replaced with lush forest. Plants unlike any she'd ever seen reached for the sky with the confidence of birds taking flight. Plush white clouds drifted on warm winds, and strange animals moved about the landscape, their colors more vibrant than any human eye could make sense of. Giant creatures strode about the landscape, living off the abundance of food, multiple legs and eyes, and vestigial body parts Sophie had no name for, sprouted off the beasts. Somehow, she sensed they meant her no harm, that they lived here in an Eden-like paradise, undisturbed and unthreatened. A river washed through this valley, stretching from somewhere far in the distance. Even from Sophie's height, she could not discern its source. A mountain? An underground spring, maybe? Deep within her, a voice told her this was what had been. The truth, obscured by time. A world forgotten by almost all. It was hidden in the very genetic material passed down through the organics. This was their old world. All of it seemed to shift, swirling into a mass of gray and black. Smog filled the landscape, and trees burned. Huge animals screeched as beams of plasma lanced through their bodies. Mechanical spiders strutted over the land, and blue orbs glowed between the husks of dead plants. The river had dwindled to a stream. Murky brown sludge flowed slowly through the ravine. A sudden force grabbed hold of Sophie and dragged her through the atmosphere. She choked on the smoke drifting from ruinous jumbles of machines and metallic objects she assumed were evidence of some civilized society. Then she was falling, plummeting back to the surface. Air tore at her skin and hair. She let out a scream that was stifled by everything rushing past. Her stomach flipped and she lost control. Sky and ground swirled in a never-ending kaleidoscope. She braced to slam against the ground. Her body would hit with a force that would tear her into individual molecules. Centimeters above the ground, she stopped. Hovering. The world was no longer a smelting of burned earth and metal. Instead, it was a landscape that gleamed black. An iron kingdom dotted with blue orbs. The sky erupted in flame and light as spaceships tore off into the abyss above them, and others careened toward the landscape, landing amid the obsidian strongholds. Spiders and sentinels and other aliens, Sophie didn't recognize, unloaded blue orbs. Those orbs were plastered across the otherwise bleak landscape. "I don't understand," Sophie said. "Why are you showing me this?" Her voice seemed to break whatever spell had taken hold. Everything vanished, like sand blown in the wind. She walked alone in a landscape as barren as the one the rhino had been driving through. A few rock formations and mountains in the background looked familiar. There was no sign of the rhino. Instead, she wandered alone. A glow drew her toward the horizon. No longer hindered by pain in her joints or muscles, she sprinted for it. This must be it. This was the NTC ship they were headed toward. She crested a hill, and the light from the ship hit her with an almost palpable force. Shielding her eyes with her hands, she climbed toward the intense glow. A warmth spread from the ship, and she let it envelop her until her eyes adjusted to its brightness. There, sitting before her, was a ship like the sunspot. There was no damage evident.
big white letters emblazoned across its side announced,
Shekundo Kasu.
Her vision tunneled. This was the ship Hoffman had taken to Mars. Hope sprang fresh within her once again like rain after a fire. It washed away the ash of loss and vanquished the smoldering remains of despair. This wasn't the colony, but it was the next step toward it.
Near the Shekundo Kasu was another ship,
smooth curves and azure highlights along an ebony shell. No more than a tenth the size of the biosphere ship, it fits snugly against it, nearly camouflaged by the shadow of the NTC ship. Out of the smaller ship came spiders. They trailed between the NTC vessel and the small ship like ants carrying cargo.
My God,
Sophie thought.
We're headed right into a trap.
Every nerve in her body lit up with a million lightning strikes scorching under her flesh. She clenched her eyelids closed, repeating a silent mantra to take her back to the others. She had to warn them. Red flashed beneath her eyelids with every stroke, and her muscles quivered. Her eyelids burst open, releasing her into the real world, and she gasped for breath. She'd beaten the nanobot's hold on her. At least this time. Sweat rolled down her forehead, and she shot upright. The tang of cryostat fluid once again swamped her nostrils. Faces appeared around her, calling her name and dabbing at her head with rags. Everything swirled until she pressed a hand to her forehead. She forced herself up against the hands.
No,
she said, swatting them away. She lurched to the front cabin where Diego and Ort were at the driver's controls. Her knees buckled and twisted. She felt drunk.
We have to stop, she said, the words coming out in a slur. It's a trap. We have to stop.
What? Diego asked, looking at her with an incredulous, cock-eyed gaze. She tried to swallow. Her tongue was swollen. When she tried speaking again, it was as though she was talking through a mouthful of cotton.
We have to turn back. The organics are there. They're at the Shekundo Kasu.
Emmanuel put a hand gently on her shoulder.
We have to stop, Sophie said, facing him.
We are stopped, Diego replied. Sophie turned to look out the view screen. The world was still bathed in the blacks and greens of the night vision overlay, but there was something out there. She blinked several times to make sure it was really the ship from her vision.
That's Shekundo Kasu, Diego said.
Sophie stepped closer to the windshield. Its existence alone was a miracle. Untarnished by organic claws or firearms, looking as brand new as it must have when it departed White Sands, her eyes flitted across the terrain, searching for the aliens. But there was nothing out there. No spiders carting cargo back and forth. Not even any tracks.
Calm down, Sophie. This is Hoffman's ship, Emmanuel said. The colony has to be close, and if this ship is fine...
Holly and the kids pressed up into the cockpit area, smiling for the first time that day. But Sophie couldn't bring herself to feel any joy at the sight in front of her. Something told her this was wrong, that this was still a trap, that the place they had come to seek salvation from was the home of the aliens.
Chapter 14.
The spider's claws slammed into the sunspot's bulkhead next to David. Tremors shook through the bulkhead, making Jeff nearly lose his precarious handhold. They were so close to the top of the wall, and now this spider threatened everything. His oxygen alarms were beeping at him, and David was holding onto the wall by one hand. With a short screech, the spider bent over the side, climbing down toward David. Its mandibles clicked together, and blue saliva roped from them, spraying the two boys as it shrieked. The scratch and scrape of other spiders responding to this one echoed down the other corridors. More were on their way. Jeff was nearly out of oxygen. His brother was dangling by one arm, and the spider was inching closer. Everything Jeff had fought for was about to go to waste. All the promises he'd made his dad about protecting his younger brother seemed like nothing but a handful of lies now. Maybe it was his dad's fault for expecting too much. How were two boys supposed to survive against aliens like this? Or maybe it was Bauma's fault for leaving him and David to defend the sunspot. And maybe it was Emmanuel's fault for letting them leave to go to the turret, even though it wasn't a good spot from which to defend against the oncoming organics. The spider screeched again, the sound something close to metal scraping against metal. All its globular eyes sparkled in the flash of Jeff's helmet-mounted lights. It seemed to be telling him he had lost, that he and his brother were nothing but a meal. Prey was prey, and the first item on the menu was David. Blaming other people wouldn't stop the alien from going after his kid brother. Jeff summoned every bit of resolve he had left, straining to ignore the incessant alarms and the spiders clattering and shrieking throughout the ship. He didn't know what was going to happen next, or how they would escape the oncoming horde. He just knew he needed to take out this single spider. One of Balma's lessons surfaced in his mind. Learn to compartmentalize. Take things piece by piece, rather than trying to run all the way across a football field for a touchdown in one play, focus on the first 10 yards. Then, when you've made it that far, figure out how you're going to go the next 10 yards. That's all Jeff needed to do, compartmentalize. They would make their escape one step at a time. The first step, kill that spider before it killed David. Jeff reached across his back with his free hand. One of his boots slipped as he did so. Chunks of charred metal flaked away and pinged against the deck far below. He could feel his other boot threatening to slip, too. He didn't stop reaching until his fingers hit the device he'd been trying to reach. Yanking the EMP grenade off the strap slung over his shoulder, he activated it and tossed it upward in one fluid motion. A flash of light cast aside the darkness of the corridor, blinding Jeff. In his mind's eye, he saw the next step, still hanging onto the wall with one hand, and his boot gradually coming out of place. He slung his pulse rifle off his shoulder. Aiming with one hand wasn't accurate, nor was it recommended. It went against every ounce of marksmanship training Balma had tried to instill in him. But Balma had also told Jeff that improvisation was just as important as the rules. And a good soldier knew when to improvise. He improvised now. The pulse shots went wild, arcing up along the wall and slicing toward the spider. Best as he could, Jeff took control of his sporadic aim as though he was clumsily wielding a huge knife. The alien didn't see it coming. Shots plunged through its flesh, globs of blood spewed out, and chunks of armor sizzled with each impact. The spider paused for a second, as if shocked. It seemed to have no idea its shields had been deactivated. But its surprise didn't faze Jeff. He riddled the monster with rounds until its mandibles stopped moving and its legs curled up. Jeff nearly hooted in victory, but the cry died on his lips. The alien fell from the bulkhead. As it did, a stray leg caught David, knocking his other hand free from the bulkhead. "Jeff!" David said, eyes wide. Jeff swung toward David and, using every last bit of air he had left in his system, stretched for his brother. Their gloves connected, but lubricated as they were by the spider's spilled blood, David nearly slipped through his grip. Jeff had been looking for someone to blame for this disaster, but in the end he could only blame himself. If he dropped David, that would be on him, no one else. He grabbed David's hand as tightly as he could. He could practically hear the bones in David's hand crunch, but he didn't care. A little bit of pain was worth a life. The spider's corpse smashed against the deck below, leaving a crater in the bent metal. The legs and thorax broke apart, slime-covered fragments spraying across the floor. Jeff swung his brother closer to the wall. David's fingers trembled, but he found a handhold. Together they climbed. The frightening chorus of other spiders grew with each meter of progress they made. Jeff's heart beat even faster. Each beat was another gout of oxygen lost. A nervous sweat formed over his palms, and he could feel it soaking through his socks. "Stay calm. We're almost there." He repeated that mantra over and over as they climbed, trying to drown out the alien's screeches. It didn't work. But he did manage to control his panic enough to finally make it up the wall and onto the top deck. Once there, he finally saw the door of their target, the armory. The door hung off its hinges, charred, just like everything else. Jeff lunged for it. Each step he took sent up a puff of black dust, and he left a trail of footprints and the charcoal dusting the deck. He grabbed the lip of the hatch. His muscles burned, both from the strain and the oxygen deprivation. The door wouldn't budge. "Let me help," David said. The boy grabbed a handhold. Together they peeled back the door, leaving a deep gouge in the mangled deck. Their helmet-mounted lights flooded the space, giving it a stark white glow. Dust sifted from cracks in the bulkhead. Benches along the floor had been ripped from their struts and tossed about the space. A few mangled rifles lay in the corners, and a handful of empty magazines were strewn about, while charred flakes of plastic and paper still floated about the space. It was mostly empty. David picked up one of the busted rifles and Jeff surveyed the room. The few rifles left were damaged. His mouth went dry and he gulped. The warning lights on his oxygen alarms were flashing. 1%! He felt both defeat and relief. A bittersweet drink.
Emmanuel and the others must have escaped and took everything with them.
And the oxygen? David asked, looking lost in the middle of the empty armory. Jeff ran to the back of the space. He tore open the reinforced locker where the oxygen canisters had been stored.
His entire world seemed to fade away. His fingers trembled, and a heavy weight dragged itself through his torso. This couldn't be happening.
No, 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 Jeff said. No, no, no.
David said what Jeff could not.
It's empty.
The dark side of the moon wasn't so dark after all. Lights illuminated a base the size of a city. Noble pressed his hand against the side of his orb. All around him, the other prisoners from the ship were being transported via an assembly line of belts that reminded Noble of a massive treadmill. His orb, too, sat on one of these belts. The cigar-shaped ships had dropped them off here sometime earlier, and then the belts had clicked on, sending the hundreds of orbs toward a pyramidal structure at the center of the base. They were still a few miles away, and Noble stood with his arms folded across his bare chest, shivering. The force field on his orb was down, but a faint shimmer revealed a nearly invisible field surrounding the conveyor belt. Even if he did escape his orb, there was nowhere to run. As far as he knew, even with the organics here, there wasn't oxygen on the moon. He would lose consciousness within 30 seconds outside the force field, which was clearly designed to protect him and the other aliens. Noble pivoted to look for Ribbit. The creature was directly behind him, curled up inside its orb. The bloody crusts around the slits in its cracked hide moved up and down with each breath. It was running out of time. The sight transported Noble back to the GOA, where he had sat in his comfortable leather chair for months, watching as Earth and all its living creatures died. He felt the same hopelessness now that he had felt on the submarine, watching humans, animals, and now aliens die made him want to scream. The sound of his own voice startled him before he realized he was, in fact, screaming. Now he started to wonder if he really was losing it. But he was the only one making any noise. The aliens on the conveyor belts were all silent in their orbs. Those that had eyes had them focused on the pyramid. Noble stopped screaming to watch the approaching structure, just like the rest of the prisoners. The entire building appeared to be over 500 stories high, much larger than any skyscraper on Earth. The smooth blocks making up the exterior were massive rectangular pieces, all of them glowing the familiar cool blue characteristic of the organics. But it wasn't the size or the glow that came as the biggest shock. It was the construction. Aside from that light, everything about it harkened back to the ancient pyramids in Egypt, and those built by the Aztecs and Mayans in South America. He remembered the ancient alien theorists that believed those structures were constructs by aliens. If they could see what I'm seeing now. A streak of blue light shot out of the tip of the pyramid and lanced into the darkness of space. Noble's orb vibrated, and a violent banging followed as the light vanished in the black. About a mile ahead was an opening at the base of the structure, through which the conveyor belts were feeding the orbs into the pyramid. Noble stepped away from the wall, realization setting in. Had the organics brought them here to preserve them, or were they doing something more sinister? He scanned the base that surrounded them. On his left, an airfield supported a dozen winged aircraft with dorsal fins. To his right, 3 white domed structures protruded out of gray hills. Spiders and sentinels moved in and out of cave-like openings, much like ants coming and going from an anthill. If he had to guess, they were some sort of barracks. The aliens skittered along the conveyors, mandibles opening and closing at the view of fresh meat. Hundreds of claws kicked up a cloud of dust as the aliens came to watch. A drone patrolling the pyramid shot over the minions. Two more drones followed, and then a fourth, which circled the pyramid, leaving long arcs of blue light residue in the air. The conveyors clanked and vibrated as they drew closer to the vast structure rising above them. Noble stepped up to the wall of his orb to take a look. Roots was suspended from the top of its orb, its branch-like arms waving. He was spooked, just like Noble was. Another flash of light exploded out of the pyramid tip like a volcanic eruption. The vibration once again rocked the conveyor belt, nearly knocking his orb off the track. The outer wall touched the force field with a sizzling zap. Noble flinched and moved away from the charred skin of his orb. Four sinewy figures suddenly glimmered between the two conveyor belts at the entrance to the pyramid. The multidimensional entities stood like ghosts, watching the orbs enter their celestial palace. The same voice he was used to hearing spoke in his mind.
Your sacrifice is for the good of all species. This is a significant honor. You have completed a remarkable great journey to be part of this, Captain Rick Noble.
Another blue flash burst from the top of the pyramid. Roots reached through its orb wall with its twig arms, and Ribbit managed to make it up onto both legs, wobbly but standing to watch.
The great realm of light requires sacrifices to keep the realm alive. Today, you are part of the great realm.
Noble blinked with realization, the same realization his other alien friends had apparently come to at that moment. They weren't being preserved in some sort of Noah's Ark. They were being sacrificed to some alien god. Emmanuel checked the biomonitors again. While Balma, Diego, and Ort were scouting at the Shekundo Kasu, he and Holly were charged with looking out for any incoming organics and watching Sophie and the kids. Sonya was set to alert them at the first sign of any organic ships or ground forces moving their way. So far, it seemed their strategy of driving non-stop had given them a comfortable distance from any organic scouts, but for how long? The Rhino was just a needle in a haystack, but the aliens had more advanced technology. He worked on repairing one of the portable RVAMs that had been damaged in their flight, knowing the aliens would find them eventually. Sophie sat across from him, working on a tablet. He could not help but imagine what the nanobots were doing inside her. How they were multiplying and taking over. When would they overthrow Sophie's mind and alert the rest of the organics to their position? A shiver washed through his flesh. What if that's what she was doing right now? What if the woman he loved was betraying them even as he sat across from her, working to help save their lives? She would never do that. Emmanuel cursed himself for thinking that. "What are you working on?" he asked, looking between the wires sprouting from the RVAMP. Sophie lowered the tablet and sighed.
I'm trying to reprogram the OCT.
Emmanuel wasn't sure what she was trying to do with the handheld optical coherence tomography machine. The device used coherent light sources, like lasers, to create three-dimensional images of objects through the angles at which reflected light was scattered. It didn't use ionizing radiation to capture these images, like an X-ray, but its reliance on light sources meant it could only probe a few centimeters under a person's skin. It was useful in identifying blood vessels and things like subdermal tumors. Realization set in. You're trying to identify the nanobots, he asked.
Yes.
He shook his head. The nanobots are way too small for the OCT to visualize.
I know,
Sophie said, as if there was no contradiction between her two statements. She continued her work on the tablet.
I don't get it.
She looked up with a sad smile. Her skin was still oily, but she'd regained some of her color.
Lieutenant Smith had far higher concentrations of nanobots than I did.
I remember, Emmanuel said. He placed the RVAMP on a table and moved next to Sophie to look at her tablet. Her fingers tapped across the screen as she manipulated lines of code, used to analyze the images obtained through the OCT. It started to become clearer to him. You're not expecting to directly visualize individual nanobots, are you?
Not exactly.
Sophie shook her head and set the tablet down in her lap. I pulled up the data you transferred to the sunspot and to our data stores here. It looks like the nanobot started to clump within Lieutenant Smith. My guess is they were programmed to do that, to create, for lack of a better word, antennae within Smith. That way the bots could communicate with the organics and vice versa.
That makes sense. You never had the same numbers of nanobots, so the organics couldn't get complete control over your body.
Sophie nodded. I never had the same numbers of nanobots as Smith, but if they're propagating, I might now.
She glared at him with a gaze that made him feel like she could read his thoughts.
The OCT will be able to detect if there are clustered nanobots in my blood like there were in Smith's. If it detects them, it will mean it's too late for me. I'll be compromised, and the organics will use me against you all.
Sophie, I can't let that happen.
Sophie gestured to the R-Vamp. If I'm unable to do it, then I need you to hit me with the R-Vamp.
Painful memories surfaced in his mind. He'd watched Sophie activate the R-Vamp that had saved their lives and defeated the organics as they boarded the sunspot.
Her eyes had gone blank, crossing in different directions like a chameleon, and she'd collapsed to the ground.
No, not again, Sophie. There's got to be a better way. Maybe we can stop the signal or restrain you or...
This is the only way.
Her voice was sharp and firm. Emmanuel knew then that she had made her decision. He racked his brain for another way, but he had nothing concrete.
When we reach the colony, they'll be able to do something, Emmanuel said.
Between Hoffman and all the medical facilities, we'll heal you.
You can't save me,
she said quietly.
Silence hung in the air between them as she continued to work. It was only interrupted by the occasional chatter coming from Holly and the kids, until a voice crackled over the comms. Emmanuel's heart fluttered, but he didn't know what to do. He was afraid to push Sophie for fear of putting her over the edge.
You all got to see this, Balma suddenly said.
An image fizzled to life on the rhino's display. It took a moment for Emmanuel to understand what he was looking at. Sophie seemed to recognize it right away and traced her fingers across the image.
It's like the one from my vision, Sophie said. An organic ship.
Emmanuel marveled at the picture.
This ship looked sleeker and smaller than the others he had seen. Maybe it was only an interplanetary transport ship or something, rather than the massive warships they'd seen on Earth and orbiting Mars. But there was something else about it that puzzled him. He couldn't quite place his finger on it.
I want to see it, Sophie said.
Emmanuel pointed at the image, confused.
No, I mean I need to see it in person.
Sophie walked away from the display and started putting on an armored EVA suit. She almost stumbled as she pulled on the EVA suit's legs. Again, Emmanuel was afraid to press her. She seemed so determined. But she was also not herself.
Sophie, I really think you should stay here,
he argued, putting a hand on her arm.
I have to see it. I know that I have to.
Whatever was driving her now was something he couldn't understand.
He relented and donned a suit of his own. If she was going, so was he.
Holly, will you be okay here? Emmanuel asked.
Sonya and I will hold down the fort, she replied.
We'll help,
Jamie chimed in. Emmanuel smiled before he locked his helmet into place. He stepped into the airlock with Sophie and initiated the pressure adjustment process. Air rushed around them, tugging on their suits. Sophie's hand found his. Their fingers intertwined. For once, he felt a strange peace. His thoughts were drowned out by the noise of the air blasting around his suit and the sudden drop of pressure. The little band of people surrounding them now might be the last of the evolved primates. Billions of years had churned on their development from single-celled critters to creatures capable of flying to another planet. He took his first step out onto Martian soil, with Sophie by his side. He felt so small, so insignificant. Yes, billions of years had led them this far, and here it might all end. Everything life on Earth had fought for, the eternal battle DNA fought to propagate and spread itself into the eons,
might all have been futile.
Emmanuel carried the weight of Earth on his shoulders as he strode toward the Shakundo Kasu with Sophie.
They soon found themselves in a biosphere ship nearly identical to the sunspot, and made their way through the corridors to the vehicle hold, following Balma's directions. It was there that they found the three soldiers circling the strange ship.
No sign of them anywhere, Balma said when he saw Sophie and Emmanuel approach. Can't figure out why they'd forget a perfectly good ship inside a human one.
Sophie blanched. She started to look sick, and Emmanuel squeezed her hand. She squeezed back. They left it here for a reason, she said simply. Emmanuel looked up and down the ship, searching for some explanation as to why the organics would have left the ship here. It didn't look damaged, and there were no signs of a struggle.
I wonder, Emmanuel began to say. A transmission from the rhino cut him off, Holly's panicked voice coming through.
Sonya's detected enemy ships. Get out of there!
Chapter 15
Every cell in Jeff's body screamed for oxygen. He gulped down air, but it didn't satisfy his aching lungs. There wasn't enough oxygen in the thin Martian atmosphere, and his suit had no more to offer. His fingers started to go numb, and he looked at David. His younger brother gazed back, a worried expression on his face.
"We've got to find you oxygen," David said.
Lack of oxygen wasn't the only thing that might kill them. The sounds of spiders approaching carried up to them. Jeff started to stumble out of the armory and back into the corridors. The rifles on his back clanked together. He had no real plan, but his mind told him he had to move. A nearly unquenchable urge to take off his helmet screamed at him. His fingers even coiled around the lip where the helmet met the suit.
"Don't, Jeff,"
David tugged on his arm. Jeff's vision started to blur. His toes and fingers grew cold. The iciness swept up through his limbs. David was leading him now, rushing through the corridor. Blackness encroached on everything Jeff saw. Little needles poked the space behind his eyes, and he gasped like a fish stranded on a dock. He managed to keep his feet moving, following David. More and more he fell forward. His younger brother caught him and half-dragged him down the corridor. Jeff wanted to ask David where they were going, but no words came out. He simply kept going. The shrieks and scratching of the spiders within the sunspot seemed to fade away. Jeff couldn't tell if they were escaping the aliens or if he was simply losing his grip on reality. Pricks of light began to sparkle in Jeff's blackening sight. Reality was definitely escaping him. The words and numbers on his HUD blurred, and he began to hyperventilate. A small voice told him to calm down, that they would be somewhere safe soon. Wait, was that a voice in his mind? Or was it David's? Everything began to feel light. Jeff's world began to spin. His thoughts coalesced into great balls of goo. He just wanted to sleep. His feet were moving. Something was tugging him, pulling on him.
No, he thought. Let me rest here just a little while.
Then he lay down and let sleep take him. All the world was black. No more needles jabbing into his eyes or brain. No more cold sweeping through his body. No shrieking spiders or scratching claws. No more David tugging him down charred corridors on a destroyed spaceship. Just his soul floating in the ether.
I could get used to this, Jeff thought.
A brief thought of afterlife and heaven shone like a brilliant light. That light spread into a starburst, beckoning him.
Jeff, a voice called. It was familiar.
Jeff. Suddenly a buoyant giddiness bobbed through Jeff. The voice called again. He knew that voice.
Dad,
Jeff called back. He really was headed toward heaven. After months without him, his father would be there waiting for Jeff again, waiting to go camping and hiking, ready for a pickup game of hockey in the street with their neighbors. Oh, how he'd missed all that!
Jeff.
Dad,
Jeff called back.
I'm coming.
The light spread over Jeff, nearly blinding him. He opened his mouth and sucked in sweet air. His muscles felt alive. Everything prickled like when his leg fell asleep and he tried